9:30, worship at 10:30, and Wednesday Bible study and fellowship meal at 7 p.m. All are welcome at First Conservative Baptist Church. Thanks for tuning in to Let's Face the Issues with Dr. Gene A. Youngblood. Since 2015, Dr. Youngblood has taken scores of questions and comments on the challenging issues of the day, with the goal of motivating and informing listeners to examine the issues from a central biblicist worldview. Currently, this broadcast is heard on 3 regional stations in Florida and Georgia. Dr. Youngblood's expository preaching is also heard on these 3 stations in Jacksonville, Florida, St. Augustine, Florida, and Brunswick, Georgia. Now there's a great opportunity to expand this vital ministry to other cities. Your help is needed to accomplish this mission. Your support in any amount is crucial to take the next step in sharing God's truth in a relevant, lively, and timely way. Thanks for your willingness to support this broadcast as we prepare to face the issues on a broader scale. Please go to fcbcatjax.com or to send your best gift to First Conservative Baptist Church, 12021 Old St. Augustine Road, Jacksonville, Florida, 32258, Attention Radio. Let's Face the Issues with Dr. Gene A. Youngblood is brought to you by First Conservative Baptist Church. Now let's get back to Let's Face the Issues with Dr. Gene A. Youngblood.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us today. We're talking about an issue that I believe should be of vital interest to each and every listener. We're asking the question, after COVID, what? COVID is over, as far as we know, but how do we respond? What do we do? How do we relate to it with the losses, the injury, and the damage that has taken place as a result of it? I'm looking at a headline that talks about a suit that has been filed by Attorney General Ken Paxton in Texas. His lawsuit alleges Pfizer deceived and censored Americans over the COVID vaccine. It goes on to say the lawsuit claims that Pfizer deceived the public about the vaccine's efficacy and coerced social media platforms to silence critics amid a drive to widespread adoption and expand the commercial opportunities for Pfizer vaccine. The law alleges that Pfizer deceived the public by claiming the vaccine was at least 95% effective. Pfizer then coerced social media platforms to silence prominent truth tellers and engaged in censorship campaign to suppress content that would negatively impact sales. We're talking with an attorney today. We're talking with Jeff Childers. Jeff is with the Childers Law Firm in Gainesville, Florida. Jeff, just a couple of questions, and then we've got a caller on the line. But question number one, this being the case, how does your lawsuit play into our look in view of other lawsuits like Ken Paxton out of Texas? And I'm looking at several other class action suits filed in Texas and in California against hospitals, hospital administrations, and doctors in relationship to the CDC protocol involving remdesivir. So would that be viewed as two separate actions or two separate major focuses, or how would that be viewed in the view of what you're doing?
Yeah, I think what we're looking at with all the headlines you've been reading about the different lawsuits is something really wonderful that's happening, which is there's probably two elements behind it. One is that lawyers who have been learning all this really complicated science for a couple of years are starting to get their running gear engaged, and they're getting their fingernails under it, and you're starting to see smarter, better lawsuits be filed. The second thing that's happening is that we're getting better reception from judges than we ever have. And I think that is probably because judges are just regular people like you and me. And I think at this point, everybody knows somebody who's been vaccine injured, including judges. So we're starting to get fair hearings where previously the judges would just close their ears to our arguments because they believed it was conspiracy theories or disinformation or whatever the nomenclature de jure was. So I think that's part of what's going on. And then the other part of what's going on is that there's momentum because a great injustice has occurred. and everybody knows it. And the powers that be have attempted to suppress people's feelings of rage and injustice. But those are feelings that can't be kept suppressed. It's kind of like, you know, the lid on a pressure cooker. You can keep the lid on and pretend like there's nothing going on inside, but the pressure's just building and building.
That's exactly right. A question, in view of the fact that now Mark Zuckerberg is spilling his guts about the Biden administration forcing them to censor free speech, et cetera, would there be any culpability with Meta and the other social platforms under the, how would you say, the authority and the control of Mark Zuckerberg, knowing that these things, for example, if I were to say anything about COVID and the COVID vaccines, we've been dinged a couple of times with YouTube because some of my messages, I'll talk about the lie of the COVID vaccine and the death jab, etc. And they would cancel our YouTube broadcast because of that. Zuckerberg was doing the same thing. Do you foresee any culpability on the part of the CEO, the heads of organizations like that, in suppressing the truth?
Well, I'm going to give you a lawyerly answer and say it depends. The first thing, and it's, I know that's unsatisfying. The first thing that most people need to know is that the Constitution is a restraint on government, not on citizens.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it tells what the government can't do to us. Not, it doesn't restrict our freedom. And so Facebook is, you know, a private company. It's big, and it's maybe arguably more like a public utility. And that's a fair argument that somebody needs to make, but so far no court's ever considered that. So they're a private company, and the First Amendment doesn't apply to them. So in theory, just like you, if you owned a, you know, a coffee shop, you could say, no shirt, no shoes, no service. Even though, you know, that might be somebody's religion or they're, you know, they're protesting the way that, you know, sheep are kept or whatever, and they don't wear clothes. I don't know, whatever. It doesn't matter. As a private citizen, you're not subject to First Amendment restrictions like the government is. So nothing like that is going to be applicable to Facebook. And then the other thing is that Mark Zuckerberg, and I, by the way, I believe him, says that he was coerced.
I do too.
He says the Biden administration threatened to put him out of business unless he played ball.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's easy for us to say, well, he should have just stood up to those bullies and lost his company and did the right thing. But you know what? That's not really satisfying. So I think he may have a fair defense that he was forced to do it.
It's sad but true, but I'm just looking at it on the basis. Now there's a full-throated admission that it was the federal government that forced him to censor the free speech and block free speech as he knew he was doing. Jeff, if you would, hold on a moment. I believe we have a call on the line. Go over the question or comment, please.
Yes, Dr. Youngblood.
Good afternoon. I hope you're well.
I hope
go ahead with your question.
I just got a comment. Now, I used to go to South America at least three times within 4 to 5 years. And I used to have to get like 4 to 6 shots to go to South America. Right? And they're letting these people in. I don't believe any illegal got one of those jabs. I think they're trying to keep this stuff going. So, now this is over here now. It is over here now. Now this monkey pops and all this kind of crazy stuff. But they did not. And I repeat, I don't believe they did not give one of the illegal aliens a jab. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I'll toss that over to our attorney today. Jeff, what are your, how do you respond to that statement in question?
Yeah, Doc, I couldn't hear him completely clearly. Could you summarize his question?
You're saying that he thinks, his opinion, that none of the illegal invaders that coming in were forced to take a jab of any kind in coming in, and that's not the correct protocol if that's what they're forcing Americans to do. So how do you respond to that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say he's 100% right. That's not even a disputed fact anymore. They're, in Biden's executive orders, they explicitly exempted border crossers from vaccine requirements. So we have that documentation. It's, that's a settled fact. You know, you could, not only is it manifestly unfair because American citizens were coerced to take an experimental injection, and the longer that things go, the more studies come out showing how awful those really were and how much long-term damage they might do. But so that's unfair. But also, what about all the other vaccines? You know, you cross the border, you go to South America, then the State Department's going to require you to take a half a dozen shots. Mm-hmm. Malaria, hepatitis, you name it. Well, all those folks that came across the border going north weren't required to get any of those shots, and they're from the areas where those diseases are prevalent. So what we have is incompetence approaching malevolence. Incompetence approaching malevolence. That's how I put it.
But thank the Lord, we've got about 1 week before we switch the clock. I call it the Trump effect. We're watching that Trump effect on a national and global basis. Kenneth, thank you so much for your call. God bless you and thank you. Keep looking up as our redemption draweth nigh. Jeff, I'm going to read something from Matt Staver from Liberty Council. Okay. And it identifies with what you're saying. It says, in 1986, the U.S. government's child's immunization schedule recommended infants receive two vaccinations for the first year, DPT and the polio, and a total of five vaccinations before the age of 18. As of 2023, the FDA and the CDC childhood vaccination schedule ballooned to 73 doses of 15 vaccinations before 18. 1986, 12.8% of the children of the U.S. had chronic health conditions compared to 54% in 2007. Oddly, in 2007, in 2007 is last year the data was available, because the federal government stopped making this information public, just like it stopped making Big Pharma pay for vaccine injury deaths as far back as 1986. U.S. government's own data revealed that up to 260 million Americans have been injured or killed by vaccinations since 1990. But Big Pharma never had to pay a single dime to any one of them, thanks to Congress, on whom Big Pharma has spent billions in campaign contributions and lobbyist efforts. And it goes on to talk about what is taking place. We're giving Big Pharma absolute immunity from any liability for the deaths or injuries their vaccinations may cause. Members of Congress happily obliged their larger campaign funders and granted them total immunity. Even if pharmaceutical companies' jabs injure or kill people, pharmaceutical companies cannot be sued for damages. And it goes back to, and I believe this is the code you referred to earlier, U.S. Code 300AA-22 reads in part, no vaccine manufacturer shall be liable in a civil action for damages rising from the vaccine-related injuries or deaths associated with the administration of a vaccine after October 1 of 1988. So am I correct? That is the law that you're asking to be overturned.
Actually, no. The law that we're asking to be overturned is 10 times worse than that one. And the PREP Act was passed in 2005, so much more recently than the National Childhood Vaccination Act that Reagan passed. What happened? How did we go from two shots for infants to 72 shots for infants? Mm-hmm. The answer is very simple. It's an economic answer. In 1986, the two companies that were making childhood vaccines gave the president an ultimatum. They said they were getting sued so much for the injuries. Now, by the way, what does that tell you? That they were facing so many lawsuits. There was a lot of injuries.
Yes.
So they told the president, hey, look, we're going to stop making these vaccines because it's not profitable. We just were paying too much out in lawsuits. And so the president was faced with a bunch of mad parents who were like, well, you know, what are we going to do when we can't get these vaccines? Because these parents were convinced that vaccines are life-saving medications. So the president was put in a corner, and he worked with the Republicans in Congress, and they passed this National Childhood Vaccine Safety Act. And, you know, the rest, because you just told me, but what happened was it transformed vaccines from the least profitable pharmaceutical products into the most profitable pharmaceutical products. Because any pharmaceutical for which there's no accountability for injuries, that is, no, they don't have to reserve any money for future costs to pay lawsuits, that is an incredibly profitable product. It only costs a few cents to make the juice that's inside of those shots. And they sell them to doctors' offices and the federal government for hundreds of dollars a dose. I mean, the profit margin is incalculable. And there's no liability because the federal government will pay injuries under the childhood vaccination schedule. So that's how you get what it's called, creating a market. They created a market, and pharmaceutical companies rushed in to fill that market and to take advantage, and they kept coming up with new shots. It's totally unsurprising. It's just capitalism. The government created a false market, and the pharmaceutical companies have delivered. So that's what we're going to have to do to fix it. We're going to have to fix the economic incentives.
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, just for our listeners' edification, and some have heard me say this before, and Jeff, I know you've heard me talk about this, some of the major hospital associations had the greatest margin of net profit in the history of the medical associations and hospitals in 2021 and 2022. Ascension Hospital Group had a 572% net profit, more than the history of its organization, as a result of the COVID jab and the COVID protocol for CDC. And CDC had to go by that COVID protocol. And Jeff, we've got a caller, but right after the caller, I'm going to ask you to ponder this for a moment. With the CDC protocol, the number one medical response was to be remdesivir. I want us to talk about remdesivir, the side effects of remdesivir, and whether or not some of these class action suits on what is called bad drug, whether they'll get traction, whether that would be a sense of hope for those that are listening that maybe have had friends, family, or relatives die as a result of remdesivir. I believe we have Derby on the line. Derby, go over the question or comment, please.
Yes, if Congress passed a law so that pharmaceuticals cannot be held liable, and then there is harm being done, well, shouldn't Congress be held responsible for it too? In other words, every member of Congress who voted for that law and the president who signed that law are responsible and liable, in my opinion.
Jeff, what say you?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a that makes sense. What you just said is logical and rational. However, there is a legal doctrine that goes back centuries, if not millennia, called sovereign immunity, and the word sovereign refers to like a king, right? And so back in England, there was a law, sovereign immunity, where you couldn't sue the king because he's the king. You can't sue the king. So when the founders of our country set up the, you know, our system of representative government, they adopted the sovereign immunity idea, except with a different explanation. It's not based on the divinity of the sovereign. Instead, the idea is that since the Congress people and the president and so forth represent the people, if we sue them, we're suing ourselves. And under that logic, it doesn't make any sense because they're supposed to be enacting laws and policies that reflect what we want. So you know, if the system is working the way the founders intended, then it wouldn't make any sense to sue the representatives for doing what the people wanted. The problem, as I'm sure you're already yelling at your radio, is that the representatives don't do what we want. We don't want pharmaceutical companies to have no liability for vaccine injuries. That doesn't make any sense. A child could explain the perverse incentives that come out of a policy like that. So the system's broken. And that's why we're so hopeful about Robert Kennedy, because he literally wrote the book on how the system is broken.
Yes, absolutely. Derby, thank you so much for your call. And I pray that these hearings will place Trump's cabinet in place immediately so that we can start seeing some relief from the top down across America. Jeff? Again, thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time out of your busy schedule. Let's address that, and I'll set the stage. Lawsuits pile up alleging remdesivir killed COVID patients, despite research showing remdesivir is ineffective against any COVID-19 and can cause high rates of organ failure. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized the experimental antiviral drug for use in COVID-19 cases, and it's still being used today. Goes on with major information. The antiviral drug remdesivir is approved against COVID-19 despite its ineffectiveness. It goes further than an individual says, calling for criminal investigation into remdesivir, citing the data that may have killed upward of 100,000 people in the U.S. just in 1 year alone. It goes on to say that all of death certificates in Massachusetts, for example, 2015 through 2022, finding 1,840 deaths as a result of remdesivir. This, and I'll say this and let you respond. A study published by The Lancet found no clinical benefit for the use of remdesivir in hospital patients. U.S. government pays hospitals, listen to this, U.S. government pays the hospitals a 20% upcharge on the entire hospital bill when remdesivir is used by the hospital. I made a little footnote on my article here. It's a bonus to kill the patients. Are you familiar with the class action suits against Gilead Pharmaceutical that manufactures remdesivir? For example, and you're familiar with this, but I'll repeat it for our audience. Our oldest son was in Virginia Hospital. They tortured him to death in 71 days. The second day he was in the hospital, which they had not even certified at that point that he had COVID, they assumed that he had COVID, put him on remdesivir. The second day, it destroyed his lungs, his liver, his heart, and his kidneys. Other than that, it may be a wonderful drug. So what are the potentials as you see it? Look at another headline. Remdesivir, wrongful death landmark lawsuit filed against three hospitals in Fresno, California. And he goes on to talk about remdesivir and the ventilators that killed the patients. Speak to that for a moment.
So remdesivir is a drug that never should have been approved for use in humans. Mm-hmm. It was fabulously expensive and with liability protection, like we talked about in the last segment, incredibly profitable. The CDC mandated one treatment protocol for COVID, and that was it. Now, before I continue talking about remdesivir, imagine the irrationality of prescribing a single treatment plan for every single patient in the United States, despite all of our different genetics, all of our different pre-existing conditions, all of us taking different combinations of medications, some of us healthy, some of us not healthy, some of us underweight, some of us overweight, but yet the CDC ordered hospitals to do the same thing for every patient in this country. Justify that to me. They overrode every doctor's opinion. What do you need a doctor for if you have the CDC to tell you how you're going to be treated? It makes me furious.
It does me. It is in fact, even now, and I'm sure that you're aware of this, you can go into a physician's office. Doc, I hurt here. I cough. I sneeze twice a day, etc. He scrolls down on his computer, and I'm told there are about 350 different CDC protocols that he's looking at, and he looks at your symptoms, looks over what the CDC says. That's the prescription that he'll make based on the CDC protocol, just based on your acknowledged symptoms that he sees on his screen. We, today, in my opinion, this is my position, we no longer are treated by a physician, as you stated, as an individual with our individualities and our own DNA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a cookie cutter that fits all, and therefore that's what has taken place with the remdesivir. If they knew, and I've got documentations that according to some of these suits out in California and out in Texas, Gilead Pharmaceutical knew these side effects, and yet at the same time proceeded to use the drugs, and it's a very expensive drug. With the it's a intervention and intravenous. It goes through a drip, an IV, and it's at least one today, 2 days later, another, if you please, bag of the fluid, and it destroys the lungs, the liver, the heart, and the kidneys. I am amazed that we, as a enlightened society in 21st century America, will allow this to continue in the medical association. So when it comes to this, we got a couple of minutes left, Jeff. But when it comes down to the bottom line, another headline, remdesivir lawsuit claims counterclaims and consequences. It says, dear patient, remdesivir was regarded as a life-saving drug during COVID pandemic earlier, but now it is facing remdesivir lawsuits. It has widely been known and used as a severe CDC COVID-19 case in the hospitals. However, the growing number of patients have made an alarming claim that they have been seriously harmed and even killed as a result of it. It goes on to talk about a case in Michigan, cases in Texas, cases in California. What is your recommendation in these final moments to our listeners? How should we respond after COVID of those that have been harmed, hurt, or should they seek out legal advice? Should they simply say, well, I'm going to wait and see? What would be your recommendation for the proper protocol for the listeners today?
I want your listeners to understand the biggest problem that we're facing. You mentioned Ascension Hospital Group. They are the largest private hospital group in the country, allegedly Catholic-based. Mm-hmm. I sued Ascension Hospital. I looked at their financials. In ordinary times, Ascension Hospital Group gets over 80% of its total revenue from Medicare and Medicaid. That is, its biggest customer is the U.S. government.
You got about 10 seconds, Jeff. Go ahead.
Because the hospitals are beholden to the federal government for all their money, they do whatever the government says. That's the problem. We got to fix that first.
That's the bottom line. Jeff, again, thank you so much for joining us today on this broadcast. Thank you for your wisdom, and I pray that God will continue to bless, give wisdom and direction in the case that you're working on. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us today. Looking forward to meeting you next time on the air as once again we face the issues.
You've been listening to Let's Face the Issues with Dr. Gene A. Youngblood, pastor of First Conservative Baptist Church and president of Conservative Theological University, 12021 Old St. Augustine Road, Jacksonville, Florida. Located 1 mile south of I-295, FCBC invites you to tune in nightly, 9 to 10, for expository preaching on 91.3, 91.7, and 91.9 FM. You're invited